Well, end up coming over and sleeping next to us like a dog, literally, because it thought, I don't know if it's he or she, that between the moms and the one dad, that the safest group to be with was us. So, and this is a 3.5, 4-year-old that's probably weighing 400 pounds, and it curled up literally right next to us. I have a photograph, our guide right there on the ground, and right on the other side of him is this goober just laying there. So that's the big scary bears.
Greetings and welcome everyone this week to another episode of our Camera Cafe Show podcast. I'm your host Tom Jacob, and I'm glad you tune in today to listen to amazing photographers, their stories, and move your own photography. Our guest from today needs little introduction, as we have a master from the craft and storytelling with us. We move the podcast today to the USA, into Montana, where on the other side, a Nikon ambassador, a John Muir Award winner, the epic wildlife and conservationist Moose Peterson is waiting for us. Moose is shooting for decades the most amazing wildlife, both in the United States as outside, has been published in too many magazines even to count, and by now has written 29 books about photography. He is also a research associate with the Endangered Species Recovery Program, and of course a wonderful storyteller. It will be a bit a longer podcast, but I urge you to stick around until the end, because I know it will be worth it. Enjoy our talk. So Moose, welcome. It's a great honor and a pleasure for me being with you here tonight on our podcast.
Well, thank you so much. I'm humbled to be asked and glad we have a little time to chat.
I think it will be a very enjoyable talk. Moose, to start off a bit first, Nikon ambassador. Could you just detail that a little bit? Because I think people always think you get all the goodies for free, but you still have to buy them anyway.
Yeah, that has haunted me since day one, all that free gear. But, you know, that thing called taxes, if you think it logically, if you get a bunch of free gear, you have to declare that, and then you have to pay taxes on it, and then you don't have any write-off. So, yeah, no. Nikon ambassador. First of all, I got to tell you, I have no clue why I'm a Nikon ambassador. I'm quite humbled and honored by it, but befuddled too. I'm just an old shooter. But Nikon is very kind and has empowered us ambassadors to go out as much as we physically can to mentor and inspire and get other people involved in photography. It's really quite that simplistic. It's just getting out and talking, and I like to do that as much as possible, like we're doing right now.
I was going to say, it's the meaning also of the podcast we started, just to get people inspired and go out and make pictures, of course. And I have to mention your podcast, Moose, if anyone is interested. Every week, Moose is there on his podcast, and it gets sponsored by Bedford's Camera, where you buy all your gear.
Right. So that's where I buy all my gear, yep.
So you can give a little shout out to them, because I think it's very important to have a shop where you can go, people that know their stuff.
Well, Bedford's is a marvelous mom and pop camera store. Even though they have many locations, they give you basically that very personalized service. And because of that, they have a great inventory, great prices. And for those who go there and mention my name, you'll see a 5% discount when they check out. But more importantly than all of that, which of course is important, and photographers are gearheads, whether we need something or not, we're going to go buy it. That's our very nature. The thing about Bedford's is they've got some marvelous, marvelous people who will spend as much time as you want and require to get the answers you need. And as we both know, one of the challenges of photography is knowing the question to ask to get the answer you need or the gear, which is one of the reasons why I really love Bedford's.
It's very important. So, Moose, I want to go a bit back to the 80s when you started out. You remember what was the moment you told your wife, let's go, let's try to make this photography adventure work?
Well, it's like much of my career. I would like to say there was that kind of a moment, but it was just the way life kept directing us. It wasn't like all of a sudden a light switch clicked on, I was already, since as long as I can remember, outside. I've never been a great person inside four walls. I do much better outside. Mm-hmm. So that was already part of my DNA. And then taking photographs started, you know, with my grandfather who was doing it back, you know, at the turn of the 1900s, and then my father and brother and uncle. And I mean, it's just, that was part of the DNA as well. I thought I was going to go into more lucrative, let's say, end of photography, doing advertising, fashion, but that didn't work. So it just, the way life evolved for us, the fact that we were going to do it together, that might have been a click moment, but I don't think so, since Sharon got her degree in business and her senior project was on starting a photographic business. So it just, like I try to tell a lot of people who try to get into business today, plans are great, but life is how it unfolds. For me personally, when I decided I was going to become self-employed, literally the next day, the Gulf War started. And this is President number 41. And there wasn't a single person who had any critter pictures from, you know, North America when that Gulf War started. Mm-hmm. They wanted pictures of animals, you know, covered in oil and things like that. So, you know, right off the bat, I put myself, you could say, behind the eight ball. And it just taught us the process, which we kind of still work through today.
Yeah. Apart from all your awards, the winning of the John Muir Award, I guess it has a special place in your heart. It's an environmental award program focused on wild places and encourages people to connect and care for nature, aiming to honor the legacy of John Muir. What did it mean for you to receive it, Moose?
Well, kind of goes back prior to actually being a photographer. There is a long section of backpacking trail that starts in Southern California and goes all the way up to Yosemite. It's called the John Muir Trail, okay. Something that I did with my father. We did about 500 miles a year backpacking, and we had walked the entire John Muir Trail. And I read all of his writings. He's a marvelous writer. And I don't know how many years, I have to do the math. I can't think of it right now, but we started off, Sharon and I, throwing slide carousels and projectors in the back of the Camaro, and we drove up and down California, getting paid $25 to go speak to this Audubon group with that Audubon group for their evening programs. We did that for many years, and then the Sierra Club had us come to Yosemite, and we would spend as much as 45 days at a stretch in Yosemite Valley, and I would do evening programs for the Sierra Club. And the whole idea was to get people involved with their wild heritage. So the John Muir Award was a culmination of doing that for many years, many miles, many hours presenting. Man, it was just a really nice way of saying all your efforts are appreciated and have been noticed.
But you know, wildlife photography requires a lot of patience and persistence. And I think you are an advocate for the photographer not interfering with the animal, just waiting and let it do its thing.
Yeah, I don't chase critters. I let them come to me on their terms. I kind of liken it like being a guest at someone's house. When I go out, I feel like a guest in their world, and I try to be the best guest I can be. And then they tend just to let life unfold, and that's where the photographs happen.
And how you stay motivated? Because What we are missing always is time, and I guess you will spend a lot of time waiting.
Yeah, people think wild photography, and myself in particular, are really patient. But you just ask my sons, you'll find out I'm not really that patient. When I'm out there, it is a true love affair. Watching what's unfolding in front of me always fascinates me. Questions always come to mind. I worked for decades with biologists, pretty much hand-to-hand all the projects. And I think, especially my mentors, I drove them nuts with all the questions that I would have. But that's how I got the honorary, you know, college degrees, was being out there and asking questions. And one of my biggest honors is one that no one really knows about, and that's I was put on as a part of the group who wrote the first multi-species federal recovery plan for endangered critters. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's, I say motivated because I'm always asking questions. I ask questions of everything, whether I'm woodworking or trying to, you know, I put a new firmware in a camera to a new beta software. I'm always asking questions. And the reason simple, I just want a better way to tell a story because our critters are disappearing and I don't want my photographs to be the last record for any species.
Going back to the story side, Moose, aside from all the technical aspects we have to come over as photographers, what do you think sets apart and be an exceptional wildlife photographer? Do you think it's telling a story more than just making a picture?
Well, one of the beauties of photography, no matter the genre, is that we have the ability to insert ourselves into that photograph. The biggest manipulation of any photograph is our heart and our mind. And it's just like, again, another one of those many fortunate things that unfolded in my life. And my very first teacher, I guess probably elementary school, who was given the first lessons about how to write, she was very insistent that to write about a subject, you have to know that subject. And it's one of those lessons that I took to heart. And it's something that I really apply myself to, especially when it comes to critters. You know, they do so many different weird, bizarre things. And not that I or anybody is going to know all the answers about what we're seeing. But when you have some sort of hint or idea what might unfold in the next few seconds or minutes, a lot of times for myself, puts me in the right space, place, and frame to make that click to then bring back whatever that story happens to be. And I've been doing it for a long time. And so I started off in stills, and stills is still my main medium. It's how I think. Even though I shoot a lot of video, most of the video doesn't tend to be the peak of the action or the crescendo of the story. It's kind of like the B-roll most of the time. The heart of the issue in the story will always be in those stills.
I find it also very important, and I see it with every interview I do with photographers, me myself included. You start in a genre and more like wildlife or macro or anything that has to do with wildlife, that you start out taking pictures and you become like almost obsessed in the end of learning an animal you saw and trying to understand it and trying to bring this next time into your photography. I think it helps a lot, and I tell it always to people that the first thing you have to know is the animal you're going to make pictures of. It helps really a lot.
Well, it all starts though, also people have to remember, with your passion. If you've got passion for whatever your subject and your genre is, that'll carry you through a lot of things. And that's really quite a cornerstone to successful photography.
Moose, while many wildlife photographers, they're always drawn to very exotic places, and you are drawn to the American wildlife. And moreover, I think not most, but around your home, it's where you like to make pictures.
That's true.
Is there any place you have on your calendar you say you need to go because time is running out for an animal or something there?
Well, you know, there are lots, and every day kind of, you know, the list kind of grows a little bit. I mean, you look at some of the photographs that come of critters, like everything from Scotland to Japan and China, Vietnam, Borneo. I mean, I've said it a million times. I'll say it again. You know, North America got the short end of the stick of really colorful critters. You know, we do shades of brown, shades of gray, a couple spots of black and white, and we're done. You go outside North America and you've got the entire color wheel practically on every single bird in different ways. So those colors kind of really get my attention. I'm going back down to Costa Rica here, I guess in about a month, and I'm going specifically for the snow-capped hummingbird. But Costa Rica has got a lot of amazing, crazy-looking birds. And, you know, we are very color-centric species as humans. And if you want to get someone's attention, color makes a big difference. So that's part of it. And then there's a lot of that I've not seen. But keep in mind that moose does not do well in heat and humidity. That's, you know, even though I really want to see those birds, the idea of having to shower multiple times in a day because it's just pouring out of me, I'd rather go where it's minus 40 than, so that's a little bit of a barrier for me, is that heat and wet wall.
Costa Rica is also very good for macro. I think you should take me with you, Moose. It's a lot of tiny little animals, sure.
Then last time I was there, which has been a number of years, we put out a light cloth at night, and we had a lot of fun with all the insects that came in. It's just a biodiversity explosion when it comes to winged critters, be it insects or birds or mammals.
I have to go because I see too many pictures of such amazing, crazy, tiny animals. I have to be there. Moose, let's go on to the gear question because I think photographers that listen are waiting for that. I think, Moose, you are one of the first ones who embraced digital, or first wildlife photographers who embraced digital, no? With Nikon D1, I suppose.
Yeah, 99. Out. I was. Yeah.
99. And now you've gone all to mirrorless.
Yeah, we've been completely mirrorless now for 14, 18 months.
What's the biggest step that made you go all mirrorless?
Well, there's a couple things. The first is that with the flip of a lever, without even removing my eye from the ELV, that I can actually go from stills to video. And for my aviation work, for example, that ability to have the camera up against my eye so I can use proper hand holding and I can shoot video and stills seamlessly back and forth. That was huge. The next thing about mirrorless is the weight savings, smaller size. You know, I hate this whole idea of getting old. I don't know who invented it. They should have their head examined. But, you know, I used to really like carrying really heavy backpacks and photo packs, and I don't like that anymore. So less weight is great. The other thing is that, you know, mirrorless is taking the whole sharpness, quality of a file to another level. The mirrorless lenses that are now offered for the Z9, Z8, what have you, are just, I can't get over the Z600 F4 or the Z50 1.2. What's coming out is just absolutely spectacular. So all of those things combined, and the one thing which, to be honest with you, which has absolutely nothing to do with the file or the photograph or the story, but the one thing I absolutely just love is the fact there's no slamming mirror noise anymore, no clickety shutter noise. You know, you shoot, and I can still listen to the birds or the water. There's absolutely no interruption to that sensual overload that comes when you're outside. And I really, really love that. I mean, when I go somewhere and there's other shooters and I hear that clackety clack of a mirror, it always a little bit jarring to me. And it's like, wow, you know, for 30 plus years, I listened to that and I guess I just tuned it out because I didn't have a choice. But boy, that silence, it's golden.
I think many wedding photographers will think the same in the church.
And golf photographers, because now they can photograph that backswing.
Moose, I do a gear list question, but there is no use because everybody, I mean, if you look at your website, you have it all such marvelous detail there. Your main lens, this I would like to know, Moose, what you use the most nowadays?
Well, it's still probably going to be the big glass, the Z600 F4. That's my main critter lens, and it's probably very few days out of the year that I'm not behind it. You know, I was out shooting with it this morning and yesterday. I mean, it's a very valuable tool. So, but if you head to the website and you look at the picture at the top of my locker, you'll notice I really don't have a lot of gear. When I take clients out shooting, I'm usually low man on the totem pole when it comes to amount of gear. It's simple business, right? There's a lot of gear I would just love to have, but it's not going to pay the bills. And so I can't justify having it in my locker. So I have just the tools that I need to tell my story and no more.
But I think this comes with your craftsmanship also, Moose, because if you go out, you just know which tools you will need.
Oh. Well, we like to think we know, but there are many times that I'll grab the first lens, I go, no, and I have to go back get another lens. But yeah, you hit it on the nail head. Craftsmanship is a big part of it for sure. That's part, it goes back to my old schooling when, you know, you shot a slide and when you went click, you're done. There was nothing else. I mean, you could not stay in business sending in that 35 millimeter slide with a bunch of silver tape on it, cropping down the image to say, this is really the picture. It had to be what you saw inside that cardboard, you know, mount. So that very true economic pressure, right? Because without a sale, there's no check. Without a check, yeah, nothing. Everybody knows what happens if you don't have any money. So that has carried on, and I still go by those same things today with digital. I don't crop and post. People always find that hard to believe, and they wonder how, but it's just how I was trained. It's how I shot for decades. It's how I think. And it's also the knowledge that if I don't get the photograph, the sun will still come up tomorrow. So it's, I try to make every click count.
It's very important, this thinking. Of course, you don't crop because we are playing with wildlife, and wildlife can be very finicky, of course, and you need the right tool to make the shot. I mean, if not, people just can crop in edit. Of course, it's each his way. But I was wondering, Moose, you enjoy the editing part?
Do I enjoy it? I wouldn't say something I look forward to. I mean, even though Photoshop is the adult video game, you know, the whole process is for me at the camera. Now, with that said, the camera still has limitations. For example, you know, our vision, just staring off, we can see 14 stops of light. The camera, you know, it's at 5. So if I want you to see all that I'm seeing with my eyes, which are these incredible tools, we have to jump through some hoops to make that story come true. I've done a number of classes for KLB 1 on finishing aviation photographs. And it's just that basic, you know, I shoot for the subject and I finish for the light. So if the light's not there, then I don't take the picture to start with. I don't raise the ISO. I'm not that kind of shooter. I just take it. If the light is gone, that's just a sign from God. Just smell the roses and enjoy the moment. But if the light's there, and if there's a deficiency in that light or the camera itself, because it has, you know, it is, I call it affectionately, the cold-hearted bastard, isn't able to get all that information, then I will go into post and deal with that. And to get to the heart of your question, is there enjoyment there? Only in the fact that I guess I in my own mind, I've actually won the game. I've taken this picture. I tend to always look at that photograph and say, as I take the picture, I can finish this by doing that and that. And I never spend more than 2 minutes on an image anyway. If it doesn't work, I just take notes how I failed. Because that's how I learn, is by failing. And if I win, that's where you could say the satisfaction comes from being in post, is the fact that the thought process behind the camera actually worked out in post.
Moose, can you walk me a bit through on the Z9 with settings you have when you leave home? I suppose you have the same ones more or less active?
Well, just so folks know, I publish all my settings for the camera. So you can see every single setting on my website for the Z9, Z8. But I do have what I call a null set, or a set that the camera is always going to be at. So at the end of the day, I put all my settings back to these settings. So I pick up the camera tomorrow, I know exactly where it's at. You got to remember, I can't walk and chew gum. So if I try to do everything I can not to put a landmine out for myself to step on. With that in mind, so the camera, the lens, it'll be set so the lens is wide open. I typically shoot a wide open. The ISO is going to be 100 because I like to shoot in the basement. The camera will be set to aperture priority. That way I control the depth of focus. The camera, in its stepless manner, will take care of the shutter speed. I have the exposure compensation set to zero. And I use exposure compensation liberally to tell my story, because to me, exposure equals emotion. The camera is going to be set to continuous high. So it's going to shoot 20 frames per second if I hold that button down. But I do practice, so I can just take one shot or 20 shots. And that's simply pressure of the finger. And then when it comes to autofocus mode, it's always, I shouldn't say always, wrong word. The vast majority of time, it's going to be set to 3D, and they'll be probably put to either animal or bird eye detection. And that one thing about eye detection, just keep in mind that the camera's not really looking for a retina and a pupil and stuff. It's looking for those shapes. It's not looking for that exact eye, and it's looking at the pattern of those shapes. So in 3D eye detection for critters and for birds, I could photograph a photograph a person or a plane, and it's still going to grab the focus for me. And that's, the card's going to be wiped and the battery will be charged. That's basically how my cameras go to bed every night. Of course, they're cleaned and sensor's been checked.
I don't have the Z9, but it's beast of a camera, Moose. You think you will ever need something more? Apart from wanting is something else, but you think you will need something? Is it Z10?
You know, I had a D6, and I thought that was the cat's meow after I replaced the D5, which I thought was the most marvelous camera, which, you know, the F5, the F4, the F3, and I started with an F2. You know, I'm not the guy that's going to be able to invent all these great features, but boy, when the Nikon engineers bring stuff out and I see their imagination, it lights mine up. So to answer your question directly, I have absolutely no doubt there's more great stuff coming down the pike, and they will come up with something that my imagination never thought of, but it's a problem that that needs solving, and they're going to solve it elegantly. And I mean, for a quick example, the Z9 has GPS built into it, which for some things, for what I do, is essential when it comes to, because I collect a lot of data about critters via the photograph, and that location information, at different points in time, can help biologists, researchers. Well, connected to that is GPS log. And you turn that on when the GPS is on, and it's going to log all of your motions. And one thing I use that for is when I'm doing an air-to-air photo mission, I'll turn on when we launch. And then I'm going to exactly know where, because it's going to keep track of all of the flight, until I land again, turn it off. So then you just quickly map it. You know exactly everything about your flight. And it's like, before, I would never thought that would be like really cool or I needed it. And now I've got it. It's like, wow, that's great. I need this. So that's kind of how, you know, after the fact, I just love diving into that stuff, figuring out all these new solutions for problems that I had that really didn't think about, and then applying those things. So yeah, whatever, you know, the Z8, that's a great example. I had no clue that, for lack of better terms, you could shrink down a Z9 into the package of the Z8 and just have a great time rock and roll. I mean, other than losing your GPS and you have a smaller battery, and the smaller battery only really affects you if you shoot a lot of video, because video, no matter what you've got, eats up battery. I mean, it's just a power hungry kind of process. Other than that, the Z8 is basically a Z9 in a smaller package. Mm-hmm. I would never thought I would need or really love a smaller Z9, but I do. I love that Z8. It's a great, for lack of better terms, knock around camera.
It's a wonderful camera. And teleconverters, you use them, no, Moose, also?
I have since the very beginning, yep.
And I think now we can finally put to rest this. Photographers always think that it might degrade your image quality.
We can never put those myths to rest. That wouldn't be photography. Because then what would we discuss? We'd have to talk about what? Good light? Good stories? So it's better to talk about those things. But no, I've used Telegraphers since the very beginning, as in since 1981. They're an incredible good tool. And as far as the ones for the Z, the 1.4, the 2X, yeah, I use them all the time. And the quality is, it's still spectacular. And they still serve a great tool, especially when it comes to limiting depth of focus. So yeah, I've always used teleconverters. They are just a great tool for storytelling.
Then let's move on a bit to your storytelling, Moose. I know you told me in another talk we had, you don't like to discuss it a lot, but in the years you've been capturing wildlife, you have on your own files, what you told, 7 extinct species alone, which is both sad and it's a big eye-opener for what's happening.
Well, you know, it's either 7 or 8 bird species in Hawaii last year were said to be extinct now. So the number of critters disappearing is worse than a pandemic kind of state. Most folks don't realize that since 1970, the globe has lost 50% of its wildlife, as in it's just gone, less. So if, for easy terms, if there used to be 1 million everything, now there's only 500,000. And it is, you know, there's a proverb, a Japanese proverb that's on all my emails that I think sums up the best. You know, nature can live without man, but man can't live without nature.
Yeah, I'm going to pick you up on the 70s, what you just told. I had this week a talk for a future podcast with Will Hawks, who is an entomologist from the UK and now works in Switzerland, and he studies insect migration. And he was talking to me about hoverflies. You know, these tiny things, you know, they migrate, Moose, I never thought. And he told me that they did a study in the 70s and they did a study back now. And you know the percentage of how much they have declined? Just a wild guess.
At least 50%?
95%. 95%, Moose. So we are doing something wrong and it's better we start reversing it as fast as we can.
Well, I did a project back in the 90s with film with the black swift, one of the fastest flying birds on the planet. And their nesting cave was at about 3,000 feet altitude. And then they would fly up another 8,000 feet. And that's where they would forage on these high-flying insects. And they would open their big mouth and catch these insects. And then at dusk, they would come crashing back down, just screaming, back into the cave to feed their kids. And they had to have those insects up there. They weren't going to like feed on insects right outside the cave entrance or in the cave. They had to fly up 8,000 feet to catch their prey. So yeah, there's a lot about this world that we take for granted and we abuse, and it's going to come back and bite us.
Yeah. I was not going to ask you for a favorite animal because you will have so many, but there is one a bit related to the other question before. You feel you have an urge of capturing before it's too late? You have one on your list?
Well, there's quite a few, but there's a lot of critters out there, from the black-footed ferret to a number of critters out there I'd love to get and photograph before, you know, I think they disappear. You know, it makes it sound so simple. I had a project for over 2 decades. I worked with the Salmon King Kit Fox, which is one of the first critters to be listed as endangered here in the United States. And you get attached to things when you spend, you know, sunrise to sunset in a blind watching them, and you watch their biology unfold, and then you see the, you know, I have this one photograph of this den site, and it's the 2 adults and 7 pups. And then you fast forward 2 years and that entire den site is now a parking lot. It's all black asphalt. So it's, you know, there's a lot of critters that I would love to have photographs of and spend time with, but that thing called time tends to get in the way more often than not.
But then you always have your nemesis still, Moose. Tell me a bit about your white-tailed hare who keeps escaping your lens.
Well, we affectionately call him the bastard. And white-tailed hare is, it's not in danger or anything like that. It is actually a common rabbit. It's a hare that I spent a lot of hours on snowshoes trying to get photographs of it. I have only two pictures. One kind of is smallish in the frame and it's looking at me. And the second frame is its butt as it's hopping away from me. But it's a critter. It's here in my backyard. It's been in my backyard now for 30 years. And I see its tracks. I see its poo. And I have no pictures. And at some point in time, it's going to offer itself up and I'm going to make it, even though it might be reluctant to it, famous.
Mm-hmm. Your wife is not making fun of you with this, no?
Oh, my family keeps me humble by making fun of a lot of things that I do. So yeah, this is just one of many things that dad gets to eat crow about.
Moose, if you have to choose between going out for a bird or going out for a mammal, which one you choose?
Well, I'm very fortunate. I don't have to make that choice, but it would be birds probably. You know, I've been into birds since I was 8 years old. So it's, you know, the one thing about mammals, you just can't just walk out your door or you just can't just drive to some place and you're just going to see, you know, you just can't drive and say, oh, there are grizzly bears or, ooh, there's pronghorn, you know. Mammals are not as numerous and they're not as plentiful, where birds, you know, you can see them anywhere and everywhere. So that's probably why I have always been into birds. You know, in North America, there's, what, over almost 400% more bird species than mammals. So in North America, most of the mammals are small little guys, which I enjoy photographing and have always found it's a challenge. And so, but yeah, birds would be it.
I think because maybe we don't have any grizzlies or bison or whatever here, so it would be amazing to see it, although it might be dangerous, of course. If you do your workshop, Moose, say you go to Yellowstone to make pictures, you give your students like a class how to behave also in case of something should happen?
Well, it's not like a direct class on that, but you know, field ethics is something that I think most of my attendees learn from osmosis as much as anything else. When we go and do any kind of adventure, we take a select group of people, for example, photograph Kodiak brown bears twice a year. I write a huge paper and that is given to them long before they get up there. And then we have a Zoom call prior to gathering at location. And there's little mystery on those things. And for better or worse, I have a well-earned reputation that no photograph is worth sacrificing the welfare of a subject. But bears aren't scary. I mean, I've been working with them for 3 decades. Never been bluff charged, never been scared by them, never been frightened by them. You know, they are just an incredibly amazing critter. And most people don't realize that the bears will do one or two things when you see you. The majority of the time, they just disappear. They can disappear in a whisper of nothing. And if they don't disappear, they just hang around. So they don't go and look at us and say, boy, dinner served. It doesn't work that way. That just sells a lot of papers. It doesn't translate to the incredible experience. It's, you know, it's hard to understand unless you actually go out. But when I take someone out for the first time to be with like the Kodiak brown bears, you know, you're out in the middle of nowhere and there's I don't have any guns. I don't carry bear spray. I have some basic biological knowledge that's been passed along to me by biologists and some that I've learned in the field. And that's it. And the people, after the first time with the bears, they've changed. They have a complete new appreciation for everything because, you know, a Kodiak brown bear can stand almost 11 feet tall. It's hard to imagine, but when they stand up on their hind legs, talking about 11 feet almost. 10'9" or 10'10", I think is the record. But, you know, that's a lot of animal. And you're talking about 1,500 pounds. And you look at them and we might have them I don't know, 30 feet away, 40 feet away sometimes, and they just look at you. And they just kind of do their thing and you do your thing. And if you're a really good guest, they don't care what your thing is. And if it's photography, man, just shoot it up all you want. And they, funny story is, so bears, basically, they're with their mom for the first 3 years. And this is generalizing. It could be less, could be more. And then the day comes when mom says, hey, you know, I've touched everything. It's time to go on your own. And it's kind of a brutal separation. It's not really a kind thing. And then they become what the biologists call a goober. And when they're 3.5, 4 years old, they're scared of their own shadow. And so a couple of years ago, we're on the flats at Kodiak, and there was a goober. And there's a couple of big females, a big male. And there we were. And we weren't at all nervous or anything like that. We were just taking pictures. And this little goober didn't know which way to turn. Well, ended up coming over and sleeping next to us like a dog, literally, because it thought, I don't know if it was he or she, that between the moms and the one dad, that the safest group to be with was us. So, and this is a 3.5, 4-year-old that's probably weighing 400 pounds, and it curled up literally right next to us. I have a photograph, our guide right there on the ground, and right on the other side of him is this goober just laying there. So that's the big scary bears.
I was going to ask you, Moose, for a special moment you had somewhere, a moment where you forgot to take even maybe a picture, but I think this is already a good answer to my question.
Well, I'm afraid there are lots of those moments. It just, I get wrapped up to it in what I'm watching and the story, and I do forget to push that button. A very old saying from a very old poem says that it's forever exposed on the thin emulsion of my mind. So that's where it resides.
We can always call it back and have memories. Moose, countless magazines and 29 books by now?
Yep.
Any new project in mind for another book, number 30?
Oh, just not really per se. You know, books, there's not money to be made in books, so I try not to do many books. I have, looking at my list here, I have 4 book ideas sitting there that really haven't done much with. I spend more time, though, generating articles for magazines that are just easier to do. But yeah, I would love to do a lot of books, but that comes back to that time thing, you know? That time thing's just a killer.
Moose, despite your success, I read somewhere you mentioned that you feel you didn't have a definite breakthrough moment still?
No. You know, I read about those things. I wonder how I missed the boat. No, I don't have that one, like, I was sitting at the bar and some director came in and said, I'm going to make you famous. I never had that kind of moment. I don't think that's ever was in the cards for me. I just keep plowing forward. Despite how I might put my foot in my mouth, I just keep going right foot, left foot, and putting the photographs out there. Hopefully that I keep grabbing heartstrings that, you know, I'll make the difference I'm hoping to make.
Moose, to come back a moment to that breakthrough moment. What would you define a breakthrough moment for a photographer and how he can then push his boundaries in his own work?
Well, you know, that breakthrough moment, I always, in my own mind, was looking for that one phone call that someone's going to say, you know, we saw your image. We see all this potential. Let's just give you a bunch of money to do your thing. And that's kind of like the daydream kind of thing. But it doesn't work that way. In fact, talking strictly business, I always was, especially before the days of the cell phone, I would be in a frump when the phone bill would come and the phone bill was lower than the month before, because it meant I wasn't on the phone making phone calls, making something happen. There's a lot of misinformation when it comes, I think, to the business side of photography, that a lot of photographers, since they don't know any different, kind of get sucked in by. And that always kind of, it makes me sad. I know of a lot of really, really good photographers who didn't stick it out because they kind of got the wrong information. They thought they're going to get that great breakthrough moment and didn't realize that photography is really, when it comes to a business, is not all about fame and riches. It's about a lot of hard work and a lot of, you know, you got to put your heart into it every day. And it's a full-time, you know, 80-100 hour a week job. And the thing is, like I mentioned earlier, if you have the passion, it never feels like a job. And that's the beauty of, in the, as far as I'm concerned, the allure of the whole photographic process.
And then of course you have the advantage that you make a package, like you make the pictures and you also write a text. I suppose is something for editors is something like marvelous because they have it all in one go.
You hit the nail on the head. That's always been, you could say, the key to my success, because there's a lot more money made in multiple image sales and a text rather than just one image. But it's, you know, it's important. You know, you asked about a breakthrough moment. There wasn't one as far as the business concerned, but there was definitely one, let's say, morale booster or confidence booster. When I worked at a camera store for a number of years, and somehow I got the attention of the regional Nikon sales manager, not the rep for the store, but the actual manager. And to say he encouraged me is an understatement. He really, I want to say, probably pushed more than else. And not that he ever said, this photograph is great, or you should buy this lens. It was nothing like that. It was like, you know, you need to work harder and you need to perhaps try this, and you've got some talent, so you should go this way. And it was just a credible source who gave the pat on the back multiple times when I needed it most. And if there ever was a breakthrough moment for me, it would have been just that one important person saying the right word to keep me going, right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot. And truth be told, that's probably a big, big reason why I have always shot Nikon. I always will shoot Nikon, is because when I needed support, Nikon was there supporting me. And I don't forget those things ever.
I shoot Nikon because it's the camera that never let me down, but in a way that it can stand a bump. I mean, travel a lot and I go on donkey carts or bus or boat and the thing swings around. I broke lenses, yes, but I never broke camera body. So it's, I can trust it, and it's what is most important for me. And I know what it can do, and I know what I can do, and we'll make it work.
They're a great tool. No ifs and buts about it.
Moose, looking towards the future, what legacy do you hope that you will leave behind in your conservation and photography?
It's a great question, because it actually, for long, too long, that really kind of concerned me, the legacy I might leave. And doesn't even in the back of my mind anymore. You know, the photographs that I take, the stories that I'm fortunate to witness and to share, some of those stories are in the moment. There's no ifs and buts about it. And some of them are timeless. And if the stars align and I've done some things right, then those timeless ones will continue. And it's to be honest with you, it's totally out of my hands. Things come up that, when I say things, a phone call, an opportunity, you know, they come out of the blue. It's not like you can plan for them. And when they happen, it's like, well, that's great, it happened. Then you go, okay, for the last 10 years, why didn't that happen? You know? And then you go, okay, I don't know why it didn't happen then, it happened now. Can I make it happen again? That used to asking those questions. Like I said, I ask a lot of questions. Asking a question like that is almost pointless, because it's just the way, you know, the world turned. When people get involved in editorial photography, in the editorial business, which a lot of people need to do and they're really scared to, because they read about that rejection letter But what most people don't understand, that rejection letter is not a rejection of you as a person or as a photographer or of your photography. It just means at that particular moment when your material hit their desk, they didn't need it. Doesn't mean they won't need it tomorrow. Doesn't mean they didn't need it yesterday. It just means at that moment, they didn't need it. So you get rejected. So, you know, when it comes to my legacy, it's not really up to me. It's up to the moment.
Well, I think it's true. Like you say, don't have to worry much about it. It comes as it comes. But for the moment, Moose, I think we can all enjoy already all these marvelous pictures you make. I mean, I can go to your website and I can spend 2 hours looking through your pictures instead of doing 2 hours podcast.
Thank you.
I think we can wrap it up, Moose. But one thing I still have to know, how is your macro photography?
How is my macro photography?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sucks. It sucks. You know, my hat's off to you for what you do and others, but sticking my butt in the air, waiting for the wind to stop blowing to take a picture of some small thing, yeah, that is just not in my wheelhouse at all. Now, I like one of the things that's in my files that is extinct, which is Doolin's dune bull weevil or weevil. It's a little bug that was briefly discovered. It was thought to be gone. They rediscovered this. And we're next to the I-5 freeway, which is a major corridor going through Central California. And this little patch of, I don't think it was even grass, but it was still native, for somehow it had survived. And the little weevil was there. And how big's a weevil, this one? It's a little bit bigger than like half a pea, a little bit bigger than maybe a ladybug.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was asked, hey, can you photograph it? I'm like, sure. And, oh, man, I was... That and my foray into doing California's endangered butterflies. Just, yeah, macro, not me.
If we meet up in Costa Rica, I will show you, Moose, no problem.
I'd be grateful. I would listen to every pearl of wisdom and then hopefully not let you down with my execution.
Yeah, you will do fine, I'm sure. Well, I hope, Moose, we can catch up one day there. I will be on the lookout for your workshops. I would love to do one. And I will be in contact.
You're welcome.
Moose, thank you very much for this interview. It has been, we are talking for 1 hour. It can go on, but we have to do other things. Thank you very much, and we'll stay in contact.
Thank you, my friend. I appreciate the time and the space, and you take care. You take really good care.
You take care. Give greetings to the family and keep making pictures.
Likewise.
See you soon. Bye. Well, I think that was an eye-opening interview with Moose Petersen and the way he sees photography and the world through his own eyes. So don't forget to think about all what he just told and share your own photography maybe in stories next time. Talking about sharing, you know our podcast is available on all podcast players such as Apple and Spotify, and we are uploading to YouTube now too. So please, give it a like, a comment, and subscribe, of course, so you don't miss anything for the next episodes. I'll leave you today with a quote of the great Ansel Adams, who said, "There are no rules for good photographs. There are only good photographs." Think about that. Now go out, make your own story, and move your photography. Thanks for joining us, and see you soon.